The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. All discussion is limited to publicly available information and should not be interpreted as legal, professional, or financial advice. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license nor provide any financial services. Before making investment decisions, you should obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor.
G'day, Clayton here from Ensemble. Thanks for joining me for this podcast. It's a pleasure to be able to do this from time to time. Hopefully you enjoy. If you're not already on Ensemble, please go to ensemble.com or find us in the App Store.
Are you having conversations with clients about retirement? Are they asking how much money they'll need? Are they worried they'll run out? We're proud to introduce the new North Retirement Space on Ensemble, featuring Q&As with economists, webinars with product innovators, and unfettered access to retirement specialists to support your advice. Join the conversation today with North, a better way for retirement.
G'day, how's it going? What do you know, Striker Light? It's been a while, but I was requested to do a recording because the regular host, James, I believe, was on vacation in the Bahamas. Now, that's a lie, or maybe it's true. I can't quite remember. But regardless, I caught up with Tom. I used to work in the same office as Tom, and he's gone on to become a very successful advisor. And I've been lost here in the world of pretending to be an entrepreneur. So I figured it's the tale of two cities, my man. Right. You stuck to it because we're about the same age. You stuck to it.
Yep.
And you've bought into this really good business. And then when we caught up the other day, you were talking about you're going to, you know, buy more and over time, yada, yada, yada. And then when I was asked to do this podcast, I thought, mate, this would be a great discussion to have. So why don't you feel free to introduce yourself, the business that you're working at, and we'll get into it.
Thanks, Clayton, and good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Very welcome.
As Clayton alluded to, we shared an office 10-ish years ago.
Mm.
Over in Martin Place. I still work there. Clayton's gone on to bigger and better things. But we bonded and had some good chats during that time we were working together.
Yeah.
You know, picking apart some of the complexities, some of the issues, some of the difficulties we were all struggling with, being young and up and coming and trying to get our feet rolling.
Yeah.
Clayton couldn't sit still and decided to move on to something bigger and better. But as Clayton said, I've stuck around and just, you know, hare and tortoise. We're just going forward that way.
What's kind of cool is like all of my mates that have stuck at it have done...
Both of them?
It's you and one other guy. Have done really well in the advice space. And it's one of those things I kind of look at it and I'm like, oh my God, like if I'd only just stuck around... there's, you know, there's you, there's Benny Nash, Phil Thompson down in Melbourne. These got like you guys have gone on to do some really impressive things. And as financial planning has changed over those 10 years, what I'm kind of seeing, and you might agree or you might not, but it's essentially headed down a path of there is high net wealth. And it's moving into like a scale game. And on the high net wealth side, it's moving into, out asset consultancy and a lot of accountancy in a lot of cases. And you know, on the scale side, it's like technology.
Robo advice,
that kind of thing, right? So where where your company sits, it's really at that top end, right? Do you guys call that like ultra high net worth or like what's the terminology that you use? Private or?
Yeah, we're not out there walking up and down the pavement saying we're ultra high net worth, but
right.
I guess what we would call ourselves would be a private wealth firm.
Right.
We don't look after many clients,
yep.
But we look after them well. We know them very well.
Yeah,
we do a lot for them, and a lot of what we do is on the investment and strategic piece.
Okay? Yes.
So, the business had its origins coming out of PwC some 20-odd years ago, when, ironically, after what's happened recently, they wanted to separate advice from audit, and Subsequently, the business has gone through a number of iterations to where it sits today, being a private wealth firm focused on private clients who happen to have significant wealth behind them.
And from as early as I can remember, you guys have had the in-house or outsourced, depending on how you want to refer to it, but the asset consultancy piece.
Sure.
That's been something that I remember. You guys were the first that I'd ever come across.
Sure.
That were doing that. So without a doubt, investments have always been such a super and key part of the offering.
Mm-hmm.
When you say strategy, I'm interested to know, with your client base, is there a particular type of client that you guys look after, or is it just a case of assets under management? Because when you get into strategy, obviously, the better acquainted you are with a particular type of niche, for example, you're sometimes in a better position to be able to advise on it. So do you guys stick to a niche, or is it just an asset size kind of thing?
There's nothing explicit as to the types of clients that we work with, but we do, we're not the cheapest firm out there,
Nor
are we the most expensive.
Yep.
But I'd say for every five people who might make a call and say they're interested in maybe being a client, maybe one might come on board.
Right.
Two or three, we might refer off to another advisor who we trust and have referred work successfully to. And then one might just fall off by the wayside.
Right.
But by definition, even if it's not explicit, there is a assets under management that we look at before it's probably worthwhile both from our sense, but also from the client who's making a pretty significant investment in their family's life, in their life, by coming on board as a client.
Yep. Now, the office is full of really smart guys, right? How the hell did you end up? No, I'm being facetious, but you sort of, if you go back 10 years and even further, we were in our 20s and that was always kind of, somehow you were plucked out from the masses to go into the... How what did you study at uni? What was the connection? How'd you end up in that office?
Yeah, sure. It's a bit of a roundabout story, but I graduated with a law degree, a law and finance degree in 2008.
Right.
Where really the only thing I knew is I didn't want to be a lawyer at that stage. My father-in-law was a lawyer. I could see how stressed he was. My now father-in-law. It wasn't for me. But that was pretty much all I knew at that point in time. Then 2008, the GFC came along, which made things quite interesting and difficult to secure a job for a new grad.
Absolutely.
You might relate
to that. I went through the exact same thing, yeah.
The job market was entirely different to what it where it is today.
Totally.
So that was a challenge, and I found almost through a bit of fear that there weren't going to be any jobs, but a bit of I call it a boiler room type role where I lasted, say, 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, right.
Hated it. I was stressed, wasn't making a difference, didn't enjoy the people I was working with, could see that it was the clients weren't probably enjoying that.
Yes.
And just knew that I needed to get out of there sooner rather than later. I just happened to be going on a ski holiday to Japan, February 2009, and was literally sitting on a chairlift next to an advisor. It got speaking to him. He said, "Why don't you come and have a coffee when you get back into Sydney?" And that's where it landed. 16 years later, that's...
No way.
Now my business partner. And yeah.
You guys met on a ski lift?
I knew him indirectly, but that's where the first conversation came through there. Good story. I went from there and I didn't go straight into advising by any stretch. I started at the photocopier machine, but from there I worked my way up. And now Ian's my business partner.
Yeah.
Ian's potentially retiring in the next couple of years and I'm the natural succession for him and his business.
Mate.
He's part of the business.
Yeah. And then there's a couple of other shareholders, right? So,
sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
You stick around and continue.
Yeah. So, the business is owned by the four directors, myself, Ian included, and two others.
Yep.
Jonathan, who's an advisor, and he started the business out of PwC and also a fellow by the name of Ray Jarni, who isn't an advisor per se, but really sits and drives the – he runs the business as managing director, can see where the opportunities are, what we need to work on, what can be improved, can help manage things like the back office and the compliance aspect of the business, and really take the load off the client-facing advisors and just do the difficult task that I'm not necessarily wanting to get out of bed every morning to do.
Well, it's kind of interesting, right? Because, and that's one of the things you would almost call that layer, the management layer, right? Which a lot of kind of bigger financial planning practices have. They have a layer of that running the business side of owning a financial planning business.
Oh, Ray's got a corporate background. He has run licensees in the past. For his next role, he wanted to be doing something a little bit more intimate, and he joined us in 2014-15.
Yeah.
Doing a bit of consulting to see how we could actually improve the business. He wrote a strategic plan for us and turned around and presented it to the directors, and the directors basically looked at Ray and said, well, who's going to implement that? And Ray said, well, probably me. And from there, he's joined the business, has acquired some equity, and helps run the business on a day-to-day.
Is that his full-time job, or does he do other
things? Correct. He was consulting when he came across to us, but now his full-time role is managing director of our business. He provides me with a great level of encouragement. He helps me with my career. He's been a fantastic resource to bounce ideas off.
Yes.
Sometimes he can be a little Jack Russell nipping at you to do the little jobs that you've tried to push to the wayside, performance reviews and stuff like that. But ultimately, he's got the firm, my best interests at heart. And then, really, you look back at where the business was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, or 20 years ago before I joined, and the great success has really come through in the last decade or so.
Yeah, that's when, you know, let's assume at some point in the future, you've completely taken over, you know, you're part of the business, right?
Sure.
Do you think the strategy changes much in the sense of the world is moving kind of to these hyper financial planning firms, right? You're getting a lot of M&A out there. There's a lot of kind of growth target trajectories going on. Lots of investment. Or do you see sort of a unique competitive advantage to stay in your lane, which is kind of the maybe slower moving but more exclusive play? Do you keep the advantage? Do you tinker with it? The more control that you get over this company, especially because you've been in it so long, do you see keeping things the way they are, or do you see taking it in a particular direction?
Yeah, it's an interesting question and something that we've really given some thought over the last year or so, because I think if you're standing still, you're going backwards in our game. You know, just the costs of running the business are growing substantially each and every year, so we need to be bringing on, you know, a number, not too many, but the right and a number of clients each year to be, you know, standing still effectively.
Yeah.
I also think that advice is turning to a bit of a scale game. I don't know how the sole operator, sole advisor with maybe power planner or a couple back office can do it. I certainly couldn't, and hats off to the ones that can make it work. But I think it's incredibly difficult dealing with the challenges around compliance and running a back office and making sure everything is okay from a legal perspective is a challenge. Fortunately, in my case, we've got enough of a back office there that I don't need to be personally worrying about when my FDS is ready. I've got a resource there who will have it prepared and ready and
up to date,
ideally, for the meeting. If you're on your own, that would be a challenge, I'd say.
It was, yeah. I remember for the first kind of 6 to 12 months before I had any staff, it was just me. Yeah, it was one of those questions like, an FDS. What's that? There was an update, you know. You've got to put that extra paragraph in. And then I had, I think by the time that I'd sold the company, I was two offshore and one in the office. So there's four of us at that stage.
Yep.
One was just doing client acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And this is before I even knew how to do proper client acquisition. I'd run a Facebook campaign, which would send people to a landing page and all this.
You'd have a lot of Google leads at that stage.
Google leads and things like that, yeah, because it wasn't as competitive in that purchased environment. There was still pretty good bang for buck, especially if you're, you know, I think my service offering at that stage was, I think, about 5,000 upfront or something like that, and maybe 5 to 10,000 ongoing for a complicated client. And so if you were paying, you know, like $2,000 for to get all the way through to a lead, that was you know,
substantial,
right? Like it was certainly paying for itself. So yeah, there was had offshore client acquisition, onshore.
How many clients were you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I got up to about 50.
Right.
And I was kind of at the stage where the reason why I sold is because I'd grown a business, and it actually has a lot to do with Ensemble. At the time, it was called XY Advisor. And I sort of started the business in the only way that I was brought up to do, which was purchase it from an orphan client book, right? Like that was really, unless you went through your process, which you're going through, which is, you know, a very good process, but
it's a much slower burn, though.
It's a slower burn, but also like let's face it, like it's hard to find a good place that is willing to do that, right? So when it does work, it's excellent, but it's hard to get that. So the way that I was sort of, it was more a sure thing in terms of being able to at least start the journey.
Yep.
But certainly not a sure thing in order to continue it. And so I sort of bought this orphan book of clients, and I was going through and sort of converting them into full-time or full-service clients. At the same time, I was sort of doing client acquisition. And I'd gotten to the stage where I started to fire my less revenue, you know, the clients that I'd had kind of in the first month, in the first 6 months. And I was at that stage, and I realized that the business that I wanted wasn't the business I had.
Right.
And that was because in the kind of the 4 years between starting and selling, that I'd started with one set of belief system or one sort of idea on how to run a company or how to grow a financial planning practice. But then after spending 4 years with this, what we call Ensemble now, and learning about what everyone was doing and how it could be done, hell, working out of the same office as you guys,
yep,
I realized that I'd sort of had this kind of beyond the 50 clients that I was looking at, you know, one-on-one, I had like this big book of orphan clients that I just didn't want.
And didn't know what to do.
Yeah. And I realized that I kind of needed to start again.
Yes.
And then at that stage, you know, once I'd kind of decided that I wanted to start again, I was like, well, I mean, I'm gonna go out and really try and be an entrepreneur. And then that's when the idea of other things sort of started creeping into my mind. I'm like, I want to stay in financial services. And then the first thing was a super fund.
Yes.
I went down that path.
I remember that idea.
it was a great idea, but 18 months in, actually had a couple of VCs want to invest because at that time it was like an and the numbers were all right. But by the time I really crunched the numbers, I mean like 18 months in, I realized it wasn't going to work. Because high level, it looks like it'll work. But then once you've done all the due diligence, once you've gone through every single supply, like part of the supply chain with a super fund, and once you realize where all the issues are and costs on top of what you expect the cost to be.
Yeah, that's a scale game.
That is, it's definitely a scale game, but I realized that you would go broke before you got there.
Yes.
Unless you had like American money, like here's $50 million or whatever, which is just not what people do in Australia. And funnily enough, at the same time this was happening, do you remember Sargon? I think that was the name of it. They were down in Melbourne.
No, I don't.
Oh, okay, right. So, PayPal's co-founder, essentially co-founder along with Elon Musk, is a guy called Thiel.
Thiel, yeah.
So, Thiel invested a bunch of money in this Australian company called Sargon.
Okay.
And they went through and purchased like OneView. They purchased Madison licensee. They purchased a lot of things and then it went bankrupt. And so it ended up getting picked apart. And Thiel was out long before it went bankrupt. But the only reason why I feel even remotely okay with that kind of wild 18-month journey was that even Thiel got sucked into what looks like a really good business model. But then the more you go into it, you're like, wait a second, it's not.
It's difficult.
Yeah.
Elon could have done it though.
Elon could do anything. I was watching this thing on him last night about he wants to send out 100, he wants to do 100 flights a day in the next 20 years. He wants to get to 100 flights a day. That's insane. But anyway, we'll see. So long story short.
So how do we get onto Elon?
Yeah. Well, I think it was I realized I needed to start again. And it was during that process that I sold. And then ultimately Superfund didn't work. And at precisely that time, Roxy came along and offered us a little bit of money and kind of kicked this thing off. And it's 5 years in now of this, which is cool.
Yep. Recording podcasts with your old landlord.
Exactly. Yeah, mate. So, where then does your decision-making process go in terms of do you look to potentially offer, like extend the style of financial planning advice that you give, or do you maybe open up the window so that more of the one in fives come through, or how do you?
We're pretty clear with where our niche is and what we do well.
Yep.
We're not going to sacrifice that just to bring on more clients because then that will dilute the service and offering that we give to our existing clients. We're pretty protective of that, and we're still finding enough clients that would fit our target and bringing them on board. We shake the tree, enough will fall out.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested to ask how many clients you had at that stage. You said 50. I think I'd have less than 20 clients personally myself today.
Wow.
And maybe when my ski buddy retires in a few years' time, that might double or triple to 50 or 60 clients. So it's not many clients, but we're seeing them, four times more than that. I might be even speaking to them weekly or fortnightly.
Right.
It's very personal touch.
Yes.
The support we have with the amount of staff we've got, I think we've got one staff for every 11 or 12 clients, which is quite unique in the broader industry.
Yes.
Consequently, I think you can do the maths and work out what type of client we need to take on to make that kind of model work. Now, not saying that it works for everyone, but it works for us. And we've been here for 23 years. I'd like to think we're here for another 23 years.
Yeah.
Because I think we do what we do pretty well.
I'm interested to sort of find out we'll get to client acquisition, which I think would be super fun to jump into. But before we do that, I'd love to know what an ongoing service looks like.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
What does an ongoing service?
Well, let's say I'm a client, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're catching up at least every 13 weeks.
Yes. Yep.
Potentially more, right?
Basically, it's
what are we discussing? Do you kind of like etch out projects, and you're discussing certain parts of their strategy over certain periods of time, and then maybe there's a lull in between projects, or how do you kind of approach it?
Yes and no. Obviously, not every client is the same, and there's some clients where they're happy with a review meeting every quarter or every 4 months, and we go in, we look at the portfolio, we look at what we need to do from a strategy perspective, be it around organise and liaise with their tax advisor around contributions, pension strategies, structuring, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
But for then some other clients who it might be a bit more full service, we would produce, or it'd be like a personal CFO where we would have their own investment committee related to that client with an asset consultant that might be helping to draft an investment charter that provides direction and governance around a pot of money that the client has, a significant pot, and how that might last them for generations and beyond. Special projects might then involve looking at the ESG overlay of their underlying portfolio and how that looks, or it might look at what's the overall liquidity of their portfolio, because the types of investments we have in the portfolio wouldn't just be the vanilla, you know, cash, ETFs, bonds, managed funds, etc. There's also a fair bit of alternatives in there that may have a fair bit of complexity around them, both from an understanding perspective, but also liquidity and truly understanding what the driver of the return from that part of the portfolio looks like.
So what percentage would be in alternatives?
Oh, again,
average.
How long is a piece of string? But look, some of the more wholesale clients, it could be pushing up 20-25%.
Right.
Might be looking in what I call true alternatives.
Yep.
Not necessarily where we've got some illiquidity premium. And there's also a fair bit of, and this is a challenge we're going through at the moment, is what is actually an alternative? Now, I've always defined it as
not listed.
Oh, no, something that doesn't derive its return from equity markets or bond markets.
Right.
Okay. Now, a market neutral or a long short manager might classify themselves as an alternative manager, but really you've got an investment manager there just making a call on direction on how much beta to have relative to the market.
Yeah.
We would much prefer an alternative, which is actually a true alternative, be it like a global transport offering or something with a bit more, a global macro fund where it's systematic and not tied to an investment manager making a decision around, you know, the direction of a certain market.
Right. How often are clients coming to you with their own alternative investments that they want in their portfolio?
Oh, not huge, not particularly often. Okay. But often enough. And I think we've got the skills, the support, the contacts to be able to do a true deep dive on an asset and provide some unbiased, informed advice on, you know, what is the true risk of this investment you're bringing? Why are you bringing it? Because you went to the golf club and your mate's invested and done, you know, his golfing mate may have invested and done really well out of it, but does he truly understand what the risk of this investment might be? And we can provide some direction and steer and provide a framework for making a decision as to whether it's the right investment or not.
Wow. So is that an essentially an offering that you guys
have? Not explicitly.
Right.
No,
okay.
But, you know, if a client is paying us a fair bit of money, we want to be able to be a sounding board for what may or may not be a good idea for their portfolio.
Interesting. And would you, I mean, personally sit down and look at that, or would you reach out to maybe some VC friends or PE?
On the first run, I might have a quick look at it. And, you know, it might be very quick to make a decision as to whether it's something that's worthwhile or not.
Yes.
But you alluded to the fact that around our managed account that's been going almost 9 years now. We've got several asset consultants and a third party independent chair to provide some governance and framework around the investment decision making.
Multiple asset consultants.
That's correct. Yes.
Wow.
Okay. That's been a recent change, but it's been an important and we think beneficial change to the structure of our managed account, which
that seems very independent, right?
It does. There can be a lot of chiefs around a table.
I could imagine.
But we've been very clear and explicit as to what the defined roles are of each input into the investment committee.
Right.
Okay. So we have an investment at asset consultant purely to provide advice on asset allocation.
Yep.
And then another asset consultant to provide advice on fund selection.
Wow.
And then the third party chair to provide, to bring it all together, help us ask the right questions, move us forward if there's a handbrake or we're getting tied up in knots. But from that, we've created a structure which we think is providing a pretty good framework for client portfolios going forward.
That's amazing. How much say or how much influence do you as an individual advisor over your clients?
Sure.
How much say do you have in their portfolio, considering you got your managed account,
sure,
right? Is it 100% the managed account, or is there, again, it's probably how long's a piece of string, but like what's sort of an average, where do you end up?
Okay, well, on a straight FUM basis, a managed account might make up a bit less than half of our overall total FUM.
Right.
There's reasons there.
Yep.
Liquidity being the main one, it needs to be daily liquid. So that strikes off a lot of the illiquid assets, which we like to dampen volatility and provide a different string to the bow or a different provider of returns for the portfolio.
Yes.
A client may also have brought with them a whole bunch of assets with significant CGT implications. So we can sit there, provide advice on them, but the best advice may be just to keep that BHP that they've owned for 30 odd years and is providing a pretty stable dividend, or pretty stable, pretty good dividend stream longer term. Or a client might also have a whole bunch of term deposits providing a pretty decent core income return that just cascades and rolls off each month just to fund what they need from a liquidity basis as well. So that managed account structure would be, call it 40% of our overall.
Right. That's so interesting. And then, so let's say on average you have a 60% portfolio to deal with in terms of your client.
Yes.
You're then talking to them. You've obviously got your own sort of APL, call it, for lack of a better term, your own model portfolio that you've got a list for. Who are you discussing that list with? Do you have individual discussions with some of your asset consultant mates? Do you just share and amongst the other planners within your office? Are you talking to Ray about it? Like, or do you just talk to your client? Do you just do your own research? Like, how do you approach the other half?
Yeah, so we've got a licensee and an APL there, which we need to follow,
yep,
as most advisors should or do.
Yeah.
So that's the starting building block. Then there would also be a lot of internal discussion. A particular client may want to have more global equities outside of the managed account because they've got a big rump of BHP, if we pick on BHP again.
Yeah.
So we may add to the specific global equity options that we already have within the managed account, or we may find a fund that complements it from a style basis, or they might have a particular interest in building up the growth factor or value factor or momentum factor. And we can either add to that via funds or ETFs. And, you know, ETFs are playing a pretty big role at the moment as well.
Yeah.
As a cheap and cheerful way of getting factor exposure quickly into a client's portfolio.
I had a memory of the number of asset sort of BDMs,
yes,
that used to call me up. And it dawned on me after a couple of years that the only reason I was so popular is because I shared an office with you guys. So what they would do is they'd say, Clay, no, I'll come take you for lunch. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, you don't have to do that. They're like, we want to. And then they'd come to the office, they'd spend the first 5 minutes just trying to speak to one of you guys, and they'd be like, okay, I guess I'll take Clayton.
Yeah, it's a role or a profession that would not suit everyone, and I'm not sure it's something that I could do. You have to deal with a lot of no's. gotta keep pounding the pavement in that profession. And it's become more difficult in recent years with the rise of the asset consultant.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they might only need to have 30 conversations a year rather than 16,000 advisors out there or however many
each
year.
Yeah.
And they're also competing with the old index landscape as well. So,
yeah, it's that is one of the remarkable things that has happened to the profession as a whole. What did you? I'm not sure if you saw this, but there was a. I won't mention any names, but within a media organization, there was an article, and in the article, it talked about one of the asset consultants receiving some investment, and the way that it was sort of almost kind of alluding to was that by an advisor outsourcing their investment selection to an asset consultant, they were actually almost taking a piece of the value of their company and outsourcing. And I thought, well, I mean, that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it would just be, you know, you just got to serve, you know, you're just paying someone like your accounting, you know, you outsource your accounting, it doesn't make your company worth less.
Yes.
So has that concept sort of, because you guys are one of the OGs with using asset consultants, has that ever been a topic that's ever been?
2015, 2016, when we started to put this all together, I was wondering, well, does our role become somewhat redundant? And I think if anything, no.
Yeah.
It's just deepens our understanding and what we can provide and explain to a client as to why, you know, this fund over here or this investment idea is performed in this way. We will have an actual, you know, if the client wants it, reams of paperwork saying, yeah, you know, this is the reason, rather than, you know, it's gone up because of this factor or Trump said this, so, right, so to speak. Yeah.
You mentioned before with ETFs and then alternatives.
Yes.
I've got a controversial one for you.
Here we go.
Bitcoin. They're in ETFs now.
They are.
Does that ever come up with your size of client?
No. Yes, it's been raised.
Oh, okay. Clients. Right.
No, it hasn't met the investment threshold.
Sure. Yeah.
I've always preferred to own the picks and shovels in the mining boom, rather than hang your head on Bitcoin or whatever coin is flavor of the month right now.
Yep.
I'm doing a lot of reading, understanding blockchain and the yep, implications of what is a pretty interesting piece of technology, but who's going to be the winner there? And I always use this analogy that in the early 90s when the internet first came about, you could tell it was going to change the world and change the way we did things.
Yes.
But the two biggest companies then were Yahoo and
Jeeves.
No, AOL.
Oh, right, yeah.
Both of whom don't really exist in a meaningful way anymore.
Yeah.
In the early 90s, if you would have had a bet that who's going to win out of the internet, it wouldn't have been an Uber or an Airbnb or whoever.
Yeah. Which
didn't exist back then.
Absolutely.
You would have said Yahoo. Now, is Bitcoin...
No, that's a very good point. Is Bitcoin AOL, for example? Yeah, yeah. It's a very good point.
Oh, I'm sure of your many listeners, you're going to have some Bitcoin junkies just call me out on that. But I personally don't think I've got the
sure,
the binary decision. Is Bitcoin going to be the one or not? Yeah. I don't know. I prefer to own, if a client wants or has that risk appetite, I prefer to own a structural...
What is it? NVIDIA. Yeah, exactly. Because they're the ones that create the GPUs. Yeah. They're the picks and shovels. And that would have been
not perfectly analogous, but that is...
Tracks. Yeah. True. So, I mean, yeah, they've killed it, right? And because it's... Well, now it's getting used in AI as well. So, it's like...
This is not financial advice. It's dead.
I mean, the boom's already hit it. So, if you're going for it now, it's a... Well, on that, and we'll move off it really quickly, but just on the blockchain technology, I've thought about it, as you could imagine, I've thought about it quite a lot. And I think the best analogy that I've ever come up with is it's scarcity with scalability. And what I mean by that is if I take...
The 21 million, whatever it is.
Well, no. So if I take, just the blockchain in general, not as Bitcoin, I mean just as the technology. So if I send you an email with a Word attachment, and let's say I've created the Word file on my computer, there's only one copy of that Word file.
Yes.
Now, I email it to you. Now, there's two copies of that Word file, right? And the reason why we do this is because it's scalable. It's easy. I can flick it across and it saves me having to print it out and send it in the mail. So there's still only one. If I was to send that document via a blockchain, yes, and it was a blockchain file,
yep,
it would leave my computer. Still it would go to... So it's scarcity with scalability. So it's a very good point. Like, it will change our world.
Blockchain, no doubt.
No doubt.
Which coin?
Yeah, but how and when, I think, is a very good and valid point. I think we're still trying to figure it out. In fact, hilariously, when I was a financial planner, and this is even if we go all the way back to Darling Harbour, when we're sharing an office down there.
Were you down there, were you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I remember we used to do long walks along the promenade.
Exactly. But I remember there was a company, even all the way back then, that would allow you to receive payment in Bitcoin and it would immediately convert into cash.
Yes.
Right. So I actually signed up for it. And I, as far as I'm aware, I was the very first financial planner in the world that could get paid in Bitcoin. No one ever did.
And you're like, you lost the key. And
yeah, exactly. No, the issue was getting the cash through the licensee. So it had to sell anyway. So it was just a gimmicky thing, right? It was getting quote unquote paid in Bitcoin, but really it was just getting paid in cash. And there's one last question I got. So five calls come in.
Yep.
One drops off, three get referred out, one becomes a client.
So it's nearly 100% of the clients that we work with would have come from a referral from an existing client.
That was going to be my question. How do you attract? And it's literally two people playing golf on the golf course. One says,
yep,
have you spoken to my advisor? He's great.
So obviously there's a bit of a vetting process already in that they know the types of clients we work with.
Right.
They can give a bit of a idea of what we do.
Right.
What kind of fees we might charge.
Yes.
They might not know their personal circumstances to the nth degree, but they've got a fair idea if they're, you know, which golf club they're working, they're playing at, et cetera.
Yes.
And from that, we might have, you know, a number of phone calls or a number of meetings where we, you know, see if we can work together. It's pretty big call to make. Ideally, it's a 10, 20, 30-year relationship. So we want to get that right, and we want to make sure that the, you know, what the client's looking to achieve is also something that we can deliver. The client that wants to, you know, double their money every 5 years, not our style. Or the client wants to talk trade shares regularly, not our style either. We're all about buying good investments, holding them for the medium to longer term, and allowing them to compound and grow in that way.
Yes. Fantastic. Well, mate, it's been great to actually...
Oh, I wanted to ask you a bit about AI if you...
Mate, yeah, go for it. No, yeah, go.
Let's have a quick word about AI because I just got back from the States where I've been in a conference in Texas.
Yep.
With a bunch of about 20 advisors.
Great.
South by, where all the talk was AI and what it's going to change, how it's coming, how quickly it's coming.
Yep.
That was an evangelical being Texas. AI adherents or first movers.
Yep.
What do you see at the moment? And how's that coming to fruition?
It's the average intelligence of the average person. So, which is great.
At the moment.
So, over the next 10 or 20 years, it'll be smarter than all intelligence combined. But at the moment,
the age of singularity, that sort of piece.
Yep. Yeah. So, at the moment, it's as smart as an average person. So, to me, it's just a time saver. It is, you know, I can put multiple documents into an AI and get a summary of it. I can find data points really quickly. It's made Googling kind of irrelevant. Like I ChatGPT everything now. Like, why would I bother going to look for information that was written at some point in the past that isn't perfectly contextualized to my exact need that I have right now?
Right.
Which I can just get a better result But
so you're not using Google at all?
I basically don't use Google. So ChatGPT, everything, you know, if I got a question, I'm just going to ask a person of average intelligence that just knows everything, right? So the language that it uses is very easily to understand, and it just has a huge database of knowledge, right? And its ability to synthesize information is about an average intelligence person. So that's sort of how I use it on the day-to-day. But then on the business side, in our company, that's what we've been focused on for the last couple of years. And the purpose for us as a company is to take the conversations that are happening on the platform and turn it into research as a service for product providers and tech providers to build better products and tech for advisors.
Right.
And that's, yeah, we're really proud about that.
And are you worried or how well do you understand where your data's ending up?
Because we use the Microsoft suite. Yeah.
Microsoft suite.
Totally locked down.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Okay.
So we don't,
ChatGPT?
Yeah, I don't put any sensitive thing inside of ChatGPT. If I want to know how many cans of Coke I can fit inside the Centrepoint Tower, I'll ask ChatGPT that. But I'm not going to put any client, any confidential, any advisor piece of information within that. It's just how I use it for my day-to-day life. On the business side of things, everything's within Microsoft. They've got the competitive advantage of making sure that you keep your data.
Tell me how you're actually using Copilot, like on a day-to-day.
How we use Copilot on a day-to-day? It's just to make sense of large amounts of information. So we've got a report coming out relatively soon called What Advisors Want. It allows us to take all the conversations that are happening on the platform, run it through. You know, it might be something as simple as, what do private wealth advisors in Sydney think about in terms of insurance, right?
Right.
Now, there might not be a lot of information about that, but there may be a set of conversations where that avatar has maybe not said or done anything, but maybe clicked on and viewed a lot of.
Yep.
Right. So we know that, this is for that avatar, that's a point of interest, right? So as I've said a million times on this podcast, we don't share any personal details. We don't share names. We don't say, Tom is saying this.
Yep.
We'll say, you know, we'll take anything that you do on the platform, hide it in amongst hundreds or maybe thousands of other advisors, take all the names out, and then that becomes research. So what Macquarie used to pay Deloitte for?
Consulting.
You know, $500,000, takes 6 months to get a report, and they use a paragraph out of it. They can lean on us. We're much more specialized, much more specific. And, you know, our business is designed to be to complement the advice profession rather than kind of try to just make money from it.
And where do you see that leading the advice profession, inverted commas, if you can call it that?
Yeah.
10 years.
Well, I think about how far advice has come in the last 10 years. You know, I think we played a small role in it, hopefully more than a small role. You know, like I think that there's a lot more to do around the world. So yeah, I'm pretty pumped for it.